south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander.
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started. Now, certainly you remember, in a very recent past show, I mentioned that the Panama building and real estate boom is at its peak. Well, today we've got more reason than ever to believe the pin is in sight and about to pop that bubble. But first, let's talk about the kind of people that are visiting Panama these days. It just might surprise you. And here's some recent info from the Prensa in Panama, reporting that 46% of all tourists who came into the country last year, 2015, came from, take a guess, would you believe Colombia, number one, and second place, you'll never guess this, but it does make sense, Venezuela. And guess what? According to Panama authorities, guess what country is overstaying their visas the most? Venezuelans again. Why not? Their country's fallen apart. And when wealthy Venezuelans can get out with some of their wealth, they stay out. But let's move on. The third most frequent visitors to Panama are Brazilians, with Ecuadorians number four and Peruvians number five. According to this article, Panama tourism is up by a lot. Sounds good, right? Well, listen to this. It says, however, hotel occupancy recorded its worst year since 2006 when they first made figures available. In other words, it's the worst recorded year of all. And here are those occupancy figures. They estimated that in big hotels with over 100 rooms, 54% of the rooms went empty last year. And for smaller hotels, under 100 rooms and mom-and-pop hotels, only 46.6% of rooms were occupied for the year. Now, here's the weird part. The number of tourists who went to Panama in 2015 exceeded 2014 by 10.7%, a record. So then how can hotel room occupancy rates be in the dumpster? Because they're overbuilding hotel rooms like there's no tomorrow. It's really amazing. Go to Panama City sometime. You'll see at least 15 gigantic building cranes operating at any particular moment. Yep. Like lemmings to the sea in a boom cycle, when you have people who've never seen the bust before, they'll just keep on building themselves into oblivion. But by the way, that's fantastic news for renters and tourists. Because if you remember in a recent past show I mentioned, if you go on the internet and try to book a 3 or 4 star hotel in Panama, you might pay $100 to $200 a night. However, if you walk in the front door, in other words, you just arrive at the airport and start looking around, you can get those very same rooms for $50 or less. And now with the huge hotel industry bubble ready to pop, analysts are predicting record numbers of bankruptcies and restructurings on the horizon. So, all you expat gonna-bes and wannabes, if your dream is to open a mom-and-pop bread and breakfast somewhere in Latin America or anywhere in the world, that goes for people with Airbnbs too. Don't pick Panama. And don't pick Costa Rica either. But you knew that already, right? Oh, and you might be interested to know that U.S. citizens made up about 18% of Panama's tourism last year, and Canadians about 7%, and Europeans counted for 14%. So that means first world people accounted for about 40% of Panama's tourism last year, and about 60% were wealthier Latin Americans on vacation, which, by the way, comes as a big surprise to some people who think that Panama's tourism trade is all coming from the U.S. and Canada. Here's something most of us never knew. According to the article, the average break-even occupancy rate in Panama for a hotel hostel, that would be a bed and breakfast or a small backpacker hotel, they say just to break even, they need 40 to 50% occupancy. And for larger high-rise hotels and resorts, they need 50 to 60% occupancy just to pay the bills. So, according to those earlier statistics I gave you, looks like everyone in the hotel business is losing money. How long can that go on? And with 2,000 more new hotel rooms coming on in the next year or so, this will end badly. Unless, of course, you're the one on vacation in Panama. Then, if you play your cards right, you'll get a 3 or even 4 star hotel for the price of a flea bag backpacker hostel. That's coming soon, and I'll keep you posted. Okay, so let's talk about building commercial properties here in Latin America. That means, of course, buying some land, getting an architect, having the plans drawn up, getting the permits, etc., and finally, getting the final approval to break ground on the project. Do note, I'm not talking about residential homes here. I'm talking about businesses and commercial properties exclusively. Now, after you hear this, you're going to think, hell, I never want to build anything in Latin America. I'll just rent or buy. Now, regardless if there is a huge real estate bubble or not, which there is, you have to hear this. If you're thinking about getting into a commercial construction project from scratch in a big Latin American city, and that's the key, that would be a city or municipality over, let's say, 300,000 people. This, friends, is what you're going to be up against. Now, note, we're not talking about putting together a business itself. We're talking about just the building of the commercial property. Turns out, in most large Latin American cities, you have to visit 13 to 15 different institutions and government agencies in order to get the final approval to get your license to build. For example, in order to get a building permit from scratch in a big city like Lima, Peru, Tegucigalpa, Honduras, Panama City, Guatemala City, Cali, Medellin, Cartagena, and Bogota, Colombia, and on, you'll have to get the following permits before you get your final authorization to start building. You must have approval from the Ministry of Environment, the Ministry of Culture and Sports, the General Property Registry, the Directorate General of Civil Aviation, the National Forestry Institute, the National Coordinator for Disaster Control, the Office of Territorial Control and the District Capital Department of Labor, the Commission for Historic Sites and Antiquities, the Commission on Environmental and Land Studies, and last but definitely not least, the Municipal Water Bureau. And the average time to have all these documents approved? From 2 to 6 months, yet it'll only set you back maybe $500. Thank Buddha for small favors, huh? And of course, you'll have to have the appropriate letters, documents, and signatures specific to each of these entities. That'll keep your architect and your lawyer very busy. Now, you listeners know I've mentioned many times that Latin America is the land of the stifling bureaucracy. And of course, every politician promises in his election campaign that he's going to streamline those processes. But in fact, things just get worse and worse, which is why, in the end, everybody ends up paying bribes. But here's the good news. If you're planning on building something right outside the city limit, could be in a beautiful subdivision just one block away, suddenly all you're dealing with is a county municipality, and that's true in small cities too. Then all you and your architect have to do is submit your plans to the local municipality. That's it. Barring, of course, you decide to build right next to a river or a lake, then you'll probably need an environmental impact study. And all that really is a way for the municipality to extort a few more bucks out of you. This is the third world, you know. No matter what that study says, you'll get your permit when you pay your money. Why do you think so many mining companies have relocated to the third world? Because they can run roughshod over the environmental laws and just pay off politicians. However, because mining companies over the years have ruined so much of the environment, they're starting to get targeted by international environmental groups, and some have even been kicked out of certain countries and run out on a rail. So things are changing for the better in that respect. Anyway, as far as building a commercial property from scratch, my suggestion, don't even try it. I'd say only under very special, specific circumstances would I ever consider building anything. I mean, look, with the real estate bubble ready to pop, you'd be a clueless idiot to do such a thing. Okay, that said, let's talk about corruption in Latin America. In fact, I'm looking at a very recent article right now from a big Latin newspaper, written by and about a German named Dirk Borkenstein. He's a European political and economic investigator slash analyst specializing in, get this, Latin American corruption. And the article, in Spanish of course, is entitled, and here's the rough translation, is there anyone who's not corrupt in Latin America? By the way, I've been asked that question on occasion myself, and I always say, I don't know, I haven't met everyone yet. Anyway, in this expert first world European's opinion, he says one of the reasons why you just can never stop the corruption in Latin America is because Latin governments themselves create and perpetuate so many social and economic inequities. For example, and by the way, doesn't this sound familiar? He says, when a regular trained secretary in the private sector makes $250 a month, While a secretary with the very same credentials working for a congressman makes 5 or even 10 times as much, up to $2,500 a month, and does little or no real work and travels in high style, that sort of thing, he says, is taken for granted and is so common that there will never be anything but corruption in Latin America as long as that prevails. He says practically everyone but that tiny percentage of people already born with a silver spoon would like nothing better than to work for government. And when asked, how do you change something like that, he said you can't. It's part of Latin culture. Then he goes on to say everyone knows that politicians appoint people with virtually no qualifications to everything from cabinet posts to department heads and all levels of management in government. He says once you've entered the political space, you're immune and protected. Adding, corruption in government trickles down and is grandfathered in. And that, he says, infects the whole of Latin society. He says to begin the process of straightening out a corrupt state, first, you must reduce the unequal financial incentive between jobs in the public and private sectors. But, like he said, that will never happen. Government workers, he says, are accustomed to frequent promotions and pay raises, regardless of the performance of the economy. Man, doesn't that sound familiar? Then he says, unlike in the private sector, government workers never experience pay cuts or downsizing. So bottom line, what he's explaining is the textbook definition of a disease, a cancer, called government. And sure, he's talking about how governments cause a kind of universal corruption, or at least a kind of toleration for generalized corruption, throughout the whole of society in Latin America. Meanwhile, the same kind of things happening up in the first world, only on a much bigger scale. Okay, changing gears, this should be of interest to any of you listeners out there who are planning on coming down and starting an internet business here in Latin America. Turns out, in an interview with the owner of a large Latin IT service called Tech4Mobile, he says, depending on which Latin country you talk about, internet household penetration is between 15 and 20%. He's talking about people at home who have a 24/7 connection. Note, he's not talking about people who use smartphone for internet connections. He says, unfortunately, 95% of all the internet use in Latin America is for entertainment purposes only. Facebook, Twitter, sports, WhatsApp, YouTube. Whereas only about 5% of internet usage is for reading, research, studying, educational purposes, business and banking applications, and other non-entertainment formats. That makes you wonder what the internet use breakdown is up in the States. That said, let's switch gears again. Now, as you know, many Latin countries have a very high population of indigenous people. For example, Peru, Bolivia, Guatemala, Honduras, Salvador, Brazil, etc., and in some cases, they make up more than 40% of the total population. Now, according to data from the Inter-American Institute, they're saying that 81.2% of all working indigenous people work off the books. That means only 19% of indigenous workers pay taxes or are registered in any way with their government's social security and healthcare system. Oddly enough, they prefer it that way. They don't want to get on the books. They don't want to be on government lists, and they don't want to pay taxes. Well, who does, right? Now, that huge 81% off-the-books figure really makes me laugh. Why? Because there's a tremendous double standard here. Because, you see, throughout Latin America, every so-called legitimate business or storefront you walk into has a little sign on the cash register that says, "Be sure to demand your factura." That's a receipt. It's the law. Then there's an accompanying toll-free number you can call to report the seller if you don't get that receipt. Now, if you remember, here in Latin America, the receipts are all numbered. And there'll be the name of the business and its registration number called the NIT number. That's N-I-T number. And the business owner will have to turn in his copy of those receipts every month to the government tax office. Or his accountant will. Then he'll pay the government 10, 12, 15, or 20%, whatever the value-added tax is for that country. That's how Latin governments collect sales tax dough. Now that means if you don't get a receipt, the seller can skip paying taxes on that. Why? Because without a government-registered receipt, there's no record of that sale. Which is why so many so-called legitimate businesses love selling things to gringos, because we don't give a damn about those receipts. especially on the Gringo Tourist Trail, because most people are on vacation and they don't give a damn about any receipts. And by the way, the only time those receipts come in handy for us gringos and expats is if we have legit Latin businesses, then we can write off that stuff on our taxes. Oh, and another reason to keep the receipt is if it's for a high buck item like a TV or a microwave, for the guarantee or warranty you might get with a device. By the way, believe me when I tell you that when expats live down here permanently, most of them that do have businesses are off the books and don't pay taxes either, though some do. And who are those expats doing work off the books? Well, I'm not saying specifically, but I can tell you most of them have internet businesses because their clients can be anywhere in the world. And they collect their income by way of a bank account under the name of a SA corporation. But you knew that already, right? So then you might ask, is this illegal or not? Well, yes and no. Depends what country you're located in and how long you live there, among other things. Since, for example, if you're in Latin America, you don't have to pay any taxes on outside income, only income that comes from within that country. However, that's not true for U.S. citizens. They have to pay taxes on all outside income, but they do get that $100,000 or so foreign earned income tax exemption too. That is, if you spend at least 330 days a year in a foreign country. Now, I have gone into great detail on that in past shows. Go back in the archives and check it out. So, bottom line, my advice, obey the tax laws, but down here in Latin America, almost no one does. Why? Because all politicians are scumbags and they're corrupt, and businesses are loath to support that crap with their hard-earned bucks. And when you consider about 81% of all indigenous workers are breaking the law too, well, who are you or I to judge, especially when the indigenous people are the poorest Latin Americans of all? They're on the bottom of the totem pole, so the government gives them virtually nothing. So imagine asking one of those guys to pay his so-called fair share in taxes. What a joke, huh? Meanwhile, at your local tienda or store that's on the books, there's a sign that says you're supposed to report him if he doesn't give you one of those facturas or receipts. Talk about a social and economic disconnect, huh? So Latin governments will punish businesses who are on the books, people they know they can extort money from, yet they won't touch anybody in the informal gray economy that pay no taxes, because they know they'll have a riot or even a revolution on their hands. Remember, those indigenous people have the numbers, and they have machetes, too. Okay, speaking of Latin American salaries, here's something that almost made me want to vomit. Gringos always ask me about that fallback position, either English teacher or call center work, and here's an ad. I'm looking at a full-page ad, by the way, from a huge call center operation located in various big cities in Central America. Now, in their ad, they show here a young, beautiful, trendy, 20-something girl that looks completely gringa. No Latin features at all. And guess what it says in the title line? Do you have 85% English or more? Make up to $600 a month. And then in big letters on the bottom, it says, if you know English, you can get an awesome salary. Oh no, they're using the A word. If you listen to last week's show, it was all about the fact that normal Latins, 98% of them anyway, have never heard of or used the A word. Except for gringos and rich helicopter school kids, I've never heard anyone use it down here. But now I'm looking at it in the paper today, in bold letters staring me in the face. Where's the nearest vomitorium? Now I'm forced to change the subject. As you know, a lot of people who come down to my Latin Insider seminars end up getting residency in a Latin country. That's part of the purpose of their trip. So weeks, sometimes months ahead of the seminar, they'll ask for information and what they have to bring down to get their residencies started. And like I've said in so many recent past shows, the U.S. does not want its sheep to leave the barn, so they're making it harder and harder for you to jump through the hoops to get the necessary paperwork to start residency in a foreign country. I'm not kidding at all about this. It's not that the states are making it harder little by little. They're making it incrementally harder. For example, here's part of an email I just got the other day. It says, hey Johnny, based on the stories from others who have successfully or unsuccessfully gained permanent residency in Latin countries, what typically happens, as I understand it, is first, you get that, quote, good conduct report from your local sheriff. And if all is clean, you send it to the state authorization people, etc. However, if they're checking with out-of-state sources, which I would assume they would to validate everything, isn't it true that they might often pull up one or two misdemeanors, etc., from years past? such as a DUI, disorderly conduct, or public urination, or perhaps a restraining order as a result of a previous romantic relationship gone sour. Seems like we all have a friend or relative who's been in that soup. Thus, if there are even minor misdemeanors or felony charges on one's good conduct report, which would make it a kind of a bad conduct report, how might these things hinder your Latin residency application? What have you heard about this stuff, Johnny? Well, to tell you the truth, I've heard a lot of stories, and most of them aren't good. For example, I understand now if you have a DUI charge on your so-called good conduct report, it will not pass muster in most Latin countries, which would rule out getting your residency. Bottom line, you have to pretty much have a clean record. So how do you know you even have a clean record? Because a lot of that stuff, misdemeanors and things that might have happened in those halcyon days when you were just a snot-nosed, shoplifting high school punk who got busted with two joints in his sock at a Ted Nugent concert. Now, who knows if that stuff might be on your record still? So if you have any doubts, do go down to your local sheriff's department and ask Barney Fife for a copy of your good conduct report. And if it's clean, you'll still see a disclaimer on it, saying something like, no evidence of a criminal record shows up in this state or county. However, we can't vouch for other states and jurisdictions. It's kind of a very general qualifier saying, well, you know, you're okay in this state, but who knows about the rest? No matter, qualifier or not, a county sheriff report like that is just fine. Pass muster perfectly in some Latin countries. Like, for example, Guatemala. At least for now, but that's bound to change in the future since every Latin country is slowly but surely changing that requirement and making it a lot tougher asking for an FBI report. And of course, things are changing at the strong request of the U.S. State Department because, you know, the U.S. hands out free grants and money to cooperating friendly third world nations, right? Like, for example, Panama and Paraguay, who now require FBI reports. In fact, for Panama, it says right on the consulate website, for U.S. police records, immigration now requires FBI records instead of just state or local police records for any residency visa application from U.S. citizens or residents, etc., etc. Oh, and by the way, it also says on the Panama consulate page, get this, note that the immigration office will turn away applicants that are not dressed appropriately. Men must wear long trousers, a sleeve shirt, and closed-toed shoes. Wow, try saying that one rapid fire. Closed-toed shoes. Then it says, and women shall not have bare arms, wear shorts, flip-flops, or sandals. Which, of course, us long-term expats recognize as the standard clueless tourist gringo uniform. So anyway, you might ask, what's the difference between an FBI report and a sheriff's report? Well, the FBI is nationwide, all states, all districts. And a local sheriff's report? Just a person's state and county record, if any. Now, there are still a few Latin countries that accept a local sheriff's report. And believe me, there's a lot of flexibility there because I know of one particular case, for example, where two restraining orders and some other misdemeanor stuff showed up on his Minnesota County sheriff's report. So, switching to plan B, he visited his brother who lived in the adjacent state of Wisconsin. Then he went down to the Madison, Wisconsin County Courthouse, dragging his brother along for moral support and possible backup. And later he found out he didn't need him there at all. Then he asked for a police or good conduct report on himself from that county. And since now he was temporarily living at his brother's house, or so he said, he got himself a nice, clean police report. How about that? So is that legal? Well, technically, I guess, because he was living at his brother's house, even if it was for only a couple of weeks. He said when he got his reports, no one ever asked how long he'd been living there. So, yes, he got lucky, but those options are not going to last. For example, listen to this recent case. It's an email that I'll paraphrase a bit. It starts, Dear Johnny, my original intent for sending you this email was to explain the process of getting my residency steps in Latin America. But wouldn't you know it, someone threw a wrench into the works. Texas has now changed the process for obtaining a state-issued criminal records report. You can no longer go to the sheriff's department directly, as in the past. Now we have to go through a third-party company, then register online, schedule an appointment at a local operator, have fingerprints collected, and then send all this information to the Texas DPS, that's Department of State, for verification and a report. So, in fact, I've written down the links for folks in Texas who need to have these reports for residency. Yes, it can be maddening. Just keep in mind, as you maneuver your way through the many steps, eventually, you'll be allowed to schedule an appointment for the fingerprinting. The good news is I've started the process and I'm working my way through the mess. So, are you ready for this? Here's the process. Number one, you go to MorphoTrust USA website, and then he gives the website. Number two, once there, go to Identity Services tab, Identigo Services drop-down box. Then, number three, go to identigo.com, then he gives the website. Then select your state. Go to the online scheduling link. Number six, the next page asks for the service code, which you don't have. So click on the Don't Know Your Service Code hyperlink, and now you'll get one. Then it will redirect you to the Go Appointment Scheduling website. He gives that website too. Number eight, we are now finally on the IdentGo Texas registration page application ID process. Then you select from a drop-down box, Reason for Fingerprinting. Number nine, select A or option B, Type of Fingers to be Printed. I guess that would be human, right? Number 10, it says, Do I know my ORI? You select No there. Number 11, again, asking for a reason of the request for a criminal history record check. Select Other Purpose, Personal Review. Number 12, fill in your personal information. Number 13, they will then bring up a location for you to search an office in your area that offers the fingerprinting services. Click on Schedule. Number 14, go to the established location at the assigned time and date. Number 15, pay $25. Number 16, your information will then be sent to the DPS, that's Department of Public Safety, in Austin, Texas. Then he says in caps, do not at any time hit the return to start or back button because it'll return you to the beginning and you'll start over. Hope this information was helpful. Cheers, Johnny. Okay, so I guess he forgot to list number 17. It's optional, which is take a cyanide pill. Okay, don't you see what's happening here? Before, you just went to your sheriff's department and in 20 minutes you were finished. And now, well, you see what it's turned into. Okay, we're getting towards the end now, so let me remind you again, go to www.thenewexpat.com for all that great information and those blogs coming from John Galt himself, and of course, I'm on the site too. And don't forget, along with the show, you can follow along with the visuals on my YouTube channel. Just go to YouTube and type in Expat Files. And don't forget to subscribe. It's free.
South of the border.
You've been listening to the Expat Files, living in Latin America, coming to you twice a week from somewhere south of the border. Email me, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And if you want me to help you sort out your own Latin American plans, schedule a one-on-one consult with me. Just send an email and let me know at theexpatfiles@gmail.com. Nos vemos.